Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series. That's toughmantri.com. By VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop. RunCatalina.com, the Catalina Marathon coming up Saturday, March 10th. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation, that's challengedathletes.org. Last year, we sent out 2,448 grants, totaling $3.7 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check out any of our interviews on iTunes or on Babbittville.com. And as always, endurance lives here. Our next guest, his name is Miles O'Brien, award-winning science journalist with PBS, former CNN correspondent and anchor. Miles, thanks so much for taking time. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Bob. It's my pleasure.
You know, first of all, where'd you grow up?
I grew up on the east side of Detroit, Grosse Pointe, Michigan.
Oh,
mean streets of Grosse Pointe.
Gross. Yes. Yes. And so growing up, what were your sports?
I grew up loving ice hockey and golf. Those were my two big ones. And moved into skiing as I went along. And as I got into college, picked up this thing, running. And running led me to eventually triathlons in the early 80s. And I never stopped on those sports.
So you got into triathlon sort of in the early days. You're talking early 80s.
I did. You know, this is back, I think the term you used, when the earth was cooling, right?
The earth was still cooling.
A triathlon in Tampa, Florida. I believe it was 1985.
That was part of the USTS series. That's right.
It was. And it was, I was young, in my 20s. I thought I'd be standing and receiving a medal, for gosh sakes. And I was quickly dispelled of that notion when I ended up swum over by some of my competitors underneath a pack of swimmers, no goggles on my face anymore, looking up going, you know, the only way they're going to know I drowned is there'll be one extra bike in the transition area. So that was my introduction to triathlon. I swam out to the outer part of the course, probably did double the distance, but at least I was not near anybody who was going to swim over me, and finished that triathlon and just loved it.
I think you were saying that you remember being underwater and sort of looking up and seeing the other swimmers go by to wonder if I'm going to live.
You kind of look up and time suspends and you think, is this it? This could be it. I'm looking up at all these people swimming over me going, this is not how I planned this race.
So were you always a science guy?
Not at all. I was a history major in college. I was fascinated by journalism. Seemed like it was way too much fun to be a job, but then I took an internship at NBC in the 1980 it was, and I got the bug. The minute I walked in that newsroom, I knew that's where I wanted to be, and so I never really looked back, and I pursued journalism jobs, and I ended up working in local news for about a dozen years in various small markets, ending up in Boston, where I sit right now, in local news, and then out of the blue one day in 92, I heard that CNN was looking for a science correspondent. I had no scientific background whatsoever, but decided I would give it a whirl. And they gave me the job, which is really a testament to their courage in picking the liberal arts dude to do science.
Well, what's funny about that is sort of the good news, bad news. Hey, I got this job. Oh, crap. I better figure out. I better learn some
science. Well, I'll tell you, you know, they brought me down to Atlanta for the interview. It turned out to be a two-day ordeal, which included going out and shooting a story, you know, reading in front of the camera, all the things you might expect. But it also included a written and oral exam on science, which I failed miserably.
Wow.
And they were asking me about, you know, this is 1992, and they were asking me all about climate change. I thought it had something to do with the thermostat on the wall. And so I was lost, and I finally get, after the end of this gauntlet, to the president of CNN, Bob Fernand, and he, you know, I walk into his office, very intimidating guy, and he doesn't even look up from the folder that he's looking at his desk, and he goes, well, obviously you don't know crap about science. And I said, and this is the moment where, you know, what do you do, right? You put your tail between your legs and leave, or do you throw the Hail Mary? I threw the Hail Mary, and I said, you know what? That's why you want to hire me. Your audience doesn't know science. You don't know science. I'm just not afraid of it. And I thought that was kind of a line of BS, but it's actually true.
It is true,
because, you know, I walked into labs, and I said, hey, look, I am an interested liberal arts history major. You have to talk to me like I'm your neighbor or your friend or whatever. And it forced the scientists to get out of their, you know, scientific jargon and lexicon in a way that was actually helpful. So coming in without a scientific pedigree actually helped me, I think.
Well, and also, you're learning every single day. It's almost like you're meeting people and learning things that you're excited about, which obviously carries over to the audience.
Exactly. I feel like I tell people I have had the best scientific education anyone could ever hope for. I've learned from Nobel laureates, after all, and I've learned about the scientific process in that fashion. And I have that, really a privileged perch to see science in action, technology in action at its early stages. And what I discovered was that I found the whole thing very fascinating. And my only conclusion is that I probably wasn't taught it very well in school when I was younger. I was probably spent a little too much time trying to memorize the periodic table or something and kind of missed the adventure that is science. And I learned that, you know, with on-the-job training, and now have an appreciation for it that maybe if I'd had it earlier in my life, I would have taken a different career path. But I'm pretty happy where I ended up.
Who was the most intimidating person you were interviewing or talking to?
The most intimidating interview by far was Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb, one of the Manhattan Project physicists, who was an irascible Hungarian originally immigrant with a very thick accent, who apparently had some bad experiences with the media over the years. And he would tell me, how long would you like this to be? And I'd say, Dr. Teller, this is going to be probably about a three-minute piece on CNN. And he'd say, no. How long will this answer be in the segment? And I'd say, well, Dr. Teller, I suppose about 15 or 20-second sound bites is what we like to call them. All right, I will answer you. You use a stopwatch, and when I get to 15 seconds, you say stop, and we will do this until I get it in 15 seconds. In other words, Dr. Teller refused to be edited. He was going to give me perfect 15-second sound bites. And so we went through this whole ordeal of trying to get him to say complicated things in a short period of time without the benefit of editing. And I finally decided to fudge the time a little bit. So instead of 15, I'd call it at about 35. And anyway, he never complained about the piece, but I walked out of that one sweating.
Wow. And what did you, obviously you're going in as a blank slate. So you're learning science as you go along. Were there times where you're interviewing somebody and going, I had no idea about that. That is unbelievable. Something that really shocked you?
I repeatedly, to this day, I say that. And, it's really, when you look at good interview techniques, it's not, doing your homework is important, but more importantly, listening and asking questions that you think your audience would have on their minds is the key. You know, Larry King of CNN, formerly and now on his own, famously did not do homework for his interviews. And his point was, neither has my audience. Why should, I'm going to be an informed person generally, but I'm not going to dive in and do a lot of homework on each individual. Now, I disagree with that approach. I think that's a little extreme. But the philosophy is a good one, to go in and don't be trying to impress your subject with a lot of knowledge that you might have, but rather elicit that knowledge from them. And at times, if you have to be in a self-deprecating, disarming way, just say, disarming, self-deprecating way, I say disarming. It's when you have one arm that it kind of makes you laugh. But anyway, so in a self-deprecating way, saying, you know, that was great, but you know, I totally missed that. And can you try that one more time? And I've never hesitated to do that. You know, I don't get it. Can you try that one more time for me? Take out that piece of jargon and define it for me. And I've never had anybody say, I can't do that. They try. Sometimes they fail, but they try. And it's my job to serve as an intermediary between the world of science and all its arcane and complex nature and a mass audience. And that's a place that I've sort of landed, and I feel comfortable there.
When did you realize that you were touching a nerve, that the audience was reacting? Because again, you're covering science, and you don't usually have an audience. You've got these viewers. When did you know that they were engaged?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I started at CNN in the early '90s, we were just toying with interaction. And this idea that people can, some of the original things we did on TV, we had people send in faxes to CNN to ask a question. And then we got this newfangled email thing going. And that was, I was the first guy on CNN to solicit email responses from people. And we did this on the weekend show in the early 90s. And that was just so much fun to finally have kind of a real-time running commentary on what you were saying, what was on people's minds. And up until that point, you're relying on phone calls that may come in after the show and or not, or I've received a lot of old-fashioned snail mail in those days, but it was always on a lag. And that moment when I realized that the Internet would make it possible not to necessarily be doing a monologue, but to have an interaction, an ongoing conversation with people, was really a great experience. It changed the nature of the business in a fundamental way, and it allows you to, really address those questions that are on people's minds. You can guess what they are, but the best thing is to actually get the questions.
So, flashing forward, February 12, 2014, you're in the Philippines. And so when you traveled, did you pretty much, were you sort of the key grip, the shooter, you traveled with a small posse when you did these shoots?
Yeah, normally I go out the door with at least a photographer, and sometimes sound tech or another producer will come with me, depending on the shoots. But I'm also kind of a tight wad, and I do my stories I'm now working for PBS. In this case, it was the PBS NewsHour, and I do them on a, fixed price per story, and so I've got a little business I'm running, and I enjoy shooting. It's kind of one of the things I learned along the way, and I like doing it. And so I decided to go on this trip where I would just go one-man band. I was in Japan at first, and I was doing some stuff at Fukushima. But I hired local drivers and fixers in each case. But I thought, I can just shoot this myself, and if I need to get in the shot, I'll hand it off to the fixer and have them shoot that kind of thing. So I was basically, one-man banding. I was a man who needed no help. Little did I know that being a tightwad can really cost you.
What were the stories?
Well, I was doing some stories in Japan on Fukushima, and I've spent several visits inside the Fukushima nuclear power plant over the years. And I also, I had seen a story which I found very interesting in the Philippines on the subject of golden rice, which is a GMO rice, which is a controversial subject, anything to do with GMOs is, and it's rice which has better nutritional value than traditional rice, and is produced as a, kind of a non-profit enterprise, but is nonetheless controversial. And so it was a good, juicy GMO story, I thought. So I went down there to shoot it on my own. And I was done with shooting everything and decided to take a little time for myself and was going to sneak away to some of the good Philippine beaches I'd heard about. And I was just stacking up my gear when the accident happened.
And so basically one of the boxes fell on you, one of the crates?
Yeah, it's about a 60-pound Pelican case. It landed on my arm. It hurt like a son of a gun, made a bruise, and I was like, wasn't broken, didn't feel like, it hurt, but I was like, geez, I really want to go to the beach, and, I'm just going, this will be okay. You know how we guys are.
Sure.
Denying, denial is a powerful thing. And so I was in, you know, and I was in the Philippines. It's not like I, you know, had, you know, I wasn't connected to the medical world. So I was, you know, I was doing all the wrong things and ignoring it as best I could. And it became unignorable. I had developed something called acute compartment syndrome, which it's like internal swelling, which cuts off the blood flow, essentially. And you don't really know you're in deep trouble until it's late in the game, unfortunately. And so by the time I got to a doctor, I mean, they performed an emergency surgery called a fasciotomy, but I didn't kind of tanked on the table, and so they had to take more drastic action, and so I lost my arm above the elbow. And, you know, when I went in to see the doctor, he said, you know, this could happen. I realized at that point I was in a serious situation, but, you know, I went into it thinking, oh, that's probably they're giving me the pro forma warnings and the caveats, but sure enough, I woke up and I felt my arm,
right,
like I do right now,
yeah.
And I looked down, I was like, uh-oh, that didn't go well. So that was, quite literally an eye-opening experience.
So, but when this first happened, like you said, that day and even that evening, it was painful and swollen, but your thought was, hey, this is going to be okay. But the next day wasn't too bad, but the next evening, that when things got really
then
bad?
It got, that's what happens, and it kind of was, I was... it was a little more than 24 hours afterwards that it really, I realized I needed some attention because I was getting, tingling in my hand and that kind of thing. And that's not good when you're losing sensation. You don't have to be a scientist to know that's not good.
No, but then the hard part is you're in the Philippines. It's not like you want to necessarily go to a hospital in the Philippines.
Yeah, there's all kinds of, and you know, I asked my doctor later, you know, because this is the big question everybody asks. If this had happened in the U.S., would you still have your arm? And, you know, my doctor, you know, maybe he was being nice to me, I don't know, or because what are you going to do about it? But he did say, he said, look, you know, these things come on very quickly, and you really have to move quickly, and you have to be totally dialed in and get there fast. And it really can be a matter of minutes, that kind of thing. And he said, so there's no guarantees. And then, of course, you know, after the accident happened, I heard from the compartment syndrome nation, just about anybody on the planet who ever had it, sent me an email. And I heard all kinds of stories from people who, heroic measures, had their limbs salvaged, but they've had, you know, really not a great outcome. They've had, you know, consistent pain and numbness, and it isn't always... the preservation of the limb is not always what it's cracked up to be, frankly. So, you know, that's a little bit of cold comfort, but hey, what can I do? I was in the Philippines. I was in that mindset. I was alone. Those are the circumstances that were there, sitting there thinking about what it would have been like if I'd been, you know, on the Upper West Side of Manhattan near my doctor is probably not very productive.
No. Losing your arm... in terms of the things that have been toughest to do and toughest to accomplish, what are those?
Well, I mean, they're little things like tying your shoes.
Yep.
That takes a little bit of practice. You know, zipping a zipper is a pretty two-handed operation. That still is something that slows me down in the course of my day. You know, I don't think I'll be tying bow ties. That's not a good one. but I have gone through... you know, the list of things that are challenging kind of one by one, starting with trying to relearn how to run,
yes,
trying to relearn how to ride my bicycle, trying to relearn how to swim, which important thematically to this discussion. And the really the last thing on my list was relearning how to fly airplanes, which is something I have always done and am very passionate about. I used to own an airplane and have several thousand hours flying airplanes, and this is a big part of me. And so,
sure.
And so that is something I have figured out as well. So I can honestly say there's nothing I can't do. It's all a matter of adapting, and really more important than anything, thinking less about how you used to do it and how you're going to do it now. That's a subtle little mindset, but it's really important to accept my, you know, one-armedness and figure it out, as opposed to thinking, God, this was so much easier when I had two arms. That is a trap, and if you start going down that road, you'll be consistently frustrated.
How supportive has the challenged athlete community been?
Well, it's been the story is incredible. I had been trying to learn how to ride my bicycle because I had committed prior to my accident to riding a long ride for a charity across Michigan. It was a total of 300 miles in 2 days. It's a significant ride, and I mean, not for you guys like you. I mean, I know you do that. That's just an easy training run for you, but
that's a long way
for me. Yeah, so it's a long way by anybody's stretch. It's a long, long 2 days of riding, and here I was presented with one arm, and I had not ridden with one arm. So I tried riding without a prosthetic. I tried riding with my conventional prosthetic, and I had road rash up and down me. I was really dangerous. And what had happened was somebody from Challenge Athletes had reached out to me really just a matter of days after my accident became public knowledge. And she said, hey, you know, I don't know if you know about us, but we're here and we have a whole network of people that can help you and we can assist you with equipment. And I was floored that this organization existed. I didn't know anything about it, frankly, and the fact that they, reached out to me and made that offer meant a lot. Now, originally, at the time, I wasn't too worried about getting equipment because I had support from insurance to do that, so I didn't want to take away something from somebody who really needed it. But then, as time went on, I realized as much as anything, I just needed expertise. I needed to talk to people who've been down this road and who wanted to, do athletic events like I aim to do. And so I sent out an email back, and I said, hey, thanks, I don't need any gear, but I really need, can I talk to some people? And they connected me with Willie and one other, but I ended up connecting, and I've had an ongoing dialogue with Willie, who is...
One-arm Willie Stewart, one of the legends of endurance sports.
He is, and as I soon discovered, he's a wealth of knowledge, and he has the exact same injury I have, above elbow, left arm, And so he initially connected me with some people and some ideas on how to do it, helped me inform my prosthetist, and then I've asked him about how to rig up the bike. He helps me with it. He's just been a constant source of knowledge, given his experience. And so, challenged athletes, it's not just about, providing a fancy prosthetic or whatever, rigging up a bike. It's tapping into a community and people who are knowledgeable because they've had similar adverse circumstances and have risen to meet the challenge. And it's truly, it's been invaluable to me. And, a disability like mine is, a disability can be lonely in general, but mine in particular, there aren't a lot of people walking around with one arm, much less those who want to do a triathlon or a ride across Michigan in 2 days. And so it can be lonely, and you're trying to figure things out, and you're asking people, like the bike mechanic to help you, and they have no clue what to do. They've never met a one-arm guy who wants to ride his bike 150 miles a day for 2 days or do a triathlon. And so being tapped into that community has been such a great source of knowledge. But also, too, there's the whole idea that, you're not alone. And there's a great feeling of support there, which is not just technical, it's emotional.
Now, have you done a triathlon since losing your arm?
I did. I did. Sanjay Gupta at CNN got me involved in the Fit Nation project in a couple of years ago. The last year he did it, I didn't do the whole Fit Nation program, but I just kind of latched on. He was working on a documentary about me at the same time, and so I ended up. He said, "Hey, why don't you just come to Malibu and you'll meet these great people who are." The Fit Nation people were awesome, and so it was just a sprint. We just did the sprint level, but I just wanted to kind of see how I'd do, and it was it was a great experience. I you know, the swim was a little bit, you know.
That's the ocean. You're in the ocean
yeah,
for that, going through the waves.
We were going through the surf, and I caught a couple mouthfuls, and I ended up, you know, way behind my wave, of course. And so I'm out there, and I'm just not, it wasn't working for me. I was kind of hyperventilating. The rhythm wasn't there. I'd do three strokes and look up, and I'd be headed to Tokyo. You know, it's like, I couldn't get it straight. And there, you know, there's about every 20 yards or so, there's some David Hasselhoff type guy on a surfboard there, gnarly lifeguard dude. And so I'm like flailing around the water, and the guy goes, "Hey, dude, how you doing?" And I said, "Well, I've had better days, actually. And I got this one arm thing, and I'm swimming in circles. I just am choking, and I can't breathe." He said, "Hey, man, you're in the Pacific Ocean in Malibu, man. Take this in, brother. Lie back, breathe easy, and realize where you are, man." And I was like,
"You're right.
That's a good idea. That's a good idea." And I did that, and I was like, "He is so right. This is so awesome to be alive, to be here, to be in the blue Pacific under this blue sky in Malibu." Spent, you know, a minute or so catching my breath, and I said, "You know what? Thank you, man. You just saved my race." And he gives it, "Rock on, man." And that was it. So there you go. It just another reminder that we aren't alone here. We all need a little support along the way. And that guy saved that race for me by just, you know, saying the right thing at the right moment.
Well, and I bet while you're doing the bike ride, you're thinking the same thing. Now, back then, did you have a prosthetic arm for the bike, or were you riding with one arm?
I did. Yeah, I had finally gotten that together, and it was, you know, I've been refining it, you know, along the way. But I did have one, and so that was good because I don't feel very comfortable on the downhills with just one arm on the handlebar. And so, you know, I've rigged up my brakes so they go through a coupler so that one handle does both brakes. And then I have this kind of ball and socket kind of setup, which is, kind of, you know, it's quick release like your pedals would be or ski bonding or whatever. So if you fall, you're not stuck to the bike. And it works great. I mean, they only on a long ride, it's a little hard to, you know, stretch your back. But, you know, it's really, I've gotten to the point now where I'm very comfortable on the bike that way.
So now you've got a new challenge coming up April
7th. So the CIF kind of, you know, they've kind of woven in out of my lives, but I didn't have it, you know, I've intended to be part of your fall triathlon challenge a couple times, but
right.
Scheduling conflicts, etc. So my son, who lives in your neck of the woods in San Diego, works, he's an officer in the Navy, and he and I have done a couple of triathlons together when he was younger in high school, and he likes to cycle, likes to do all those things, and you know, the guy's a, you know, he's 25-year-old.
He's an athlete.
He's a search and rescue swimmer for the Navy. I mean, he goes into the dark sea to get people who fall off. And I'm like, geez, this guy's a specimen. So he said, "Hey, why don't we do the Oceanside 70.3? You know, it's for CAF." I was like, and he had independently just kind of stumbled into CAF. I hadn't really, you know, we hadn't talked much about what CAF meant to me. And I said, "You know what? This is the moment, and this is the race. This is exactly what I want to be doing right now. I've got a little extra poundage on me, and anyway, I need a goal, and this is the perfect cause and the perfect place, and you just goaded me into it, and you're my son, so I have to say yes." And so I'm doing it, and I've been really enjoying not just the training. I've been enjoying connecting, you know, with him about it. But it's really, you know, it was really fun to connect in a more face-to-face way with CAF and see what a wonderful organization it is.
Well, we had you at the building the other day. You got to meet some of the other challenged athletes. What's cool is for the Ironman 70.3 in Oceanside, it's a sold-out event, and CAF has fundraising slots. So where people can raise $2,000 and get a spot in the sold out Ironman 70.3. They got to be in the VIP swim wave. I think we'll have about a dozen or so of our Operation Rebound, our military folks and first responders who will be participating along with yourself. VIP pre-race lunch. They got their own race kit, hospitality tent at the finish line, all sorts of really cool stuff. Post-race massage. So when the longest one you've done has been Olympic way back in the day, but Malibu, which is a sprint, and now you're talking a 70.3. That's a long way to go. So do you have some coaching?
I do. I hired a coach. She's She's a professional triathlete based in Atlanta, April Gelati, and she is great. And she's put me on a Training Peaks regimen, and I am dutifully turning boxes green every day, whatever she says I do, and that way if I fail, it's her fault, right? Isn't that how it goes?
Absolutely. It's always a coach's fault. It's just, all you so, are
no, it's been,
is...
It's really been, you know, it helps me. I'm sure it helps you, too, to have a coach. I mean, I the idea of doing this completely, you know, this goes back to a theme of this conversation, right? Doing stuff alone is not necessarily the best thing in a lot of ways, and I think we are all empowered and stronger ultimately when we tap into a larger community, whether it's CAF, whether it's or whether it's a coach. And so it's been really great because I feel very compelled to do what she says.
And the cool part about having a coach is sort of like every single day you're like, okay, I've got that done, and I've got this done. And like you said, clicking the boxes and turning them green and realizing these are all small goals on the way to the bigger goal. Because when you look at that bigger goal, that's a long way to go, 70.3 miles one day. And especially, I don't know if anybody told you this or not, but that's not the flattest, fast course in the world out at Oceanside. The run isn't bad, but the bike ride has a couple
terrain.
Good climbs. Yeah. It's sort of a...
No, it's going to be an event to remember, and I do agree with you, though. It's really important, in like any goal in life, whatever it may be, you got to break them down, right? It's so easy to get overwhelmed when you think about something of that distance for me. You know, I know you and your audience, there's probably a lot of Ironman veterans out there, but for me, this is you know, gets my attention. I do think, however, I'd be interested in your theory on this. I think as you grow older, you actually get better at endurance sports.
No,
I think, because what you realize is it's a mind game so much, and I think as you get a little more wisdom, you're better at forcing your body to do these kinds of things, whatever you want to call it. Your mind is better at managing the event, put it that way.
Well, what we learn over time is you learn how to break things into smaller pieces rather than...
I guess that's it. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah,
it's the bite-sized component, right?
Exactly. You mentally, you can look at it and go, oh my God, 70.3 miles. That's just brutal. But then when you're out in the swim, rather than thinking, oh, I'm swimming 1.2, you're going, hey, I'm halfway to the turnaround. Oh, I'm at the turnaround. I'm halfway back. So everything becomes a positive, and you're constantly feeding positives. And, oh, my God, I get to eat something now. So, or the other side of that is you go, oh, I'm going so slow. But the positive tools that we use, because we're veterans, we've been doing this for a long time, you get right back into that mindset. And that's what I think that it comes from work experience, from life experience, especially, you know, the experiences that you've gone through. You're blue skies, you're in the Pacific, you're out there, nobody can get a hold of you, right? Nobody's going to be texting you or emailing you. You have a fun story at that Oceanside race. So we're doing this a few years ago. I was doing the announcing at the what they call the hot corner. It's about half a mile into the bike ride. And I see this woman walking back at me, and she was, you know, both her shoulders are bloody. And she's got her bike, and she obviously had just fallen. And I was like, oh, my God, are you okay? And our guys jump out, and they grab her bike and make sure the bike's okay. And I said, you know, you don't have to go do this race. You can pull out if you want. I mean, you just crashed. She crashed on a speed bump. And underneath the tower where I was at, there's a guy with a baby jogger with two kids in it and a backpack with a third kid. And she points over there and goes, I am not dropping out. I have 7 hours to be by myself. This is my day.
That's perfect.
Wasn't that perfect?
That is perfect.
The article I wrote was called Mother's Day, right? It was her day. Nobody was going to get a hold of her. Nobody had to be driven to ballerina class. It was her day. And that's what's so cool about it. That's what I love about these races. It's your day for Miles to just be with himself. And also, now, is there a battle here with your son? Is there some dollars on the line? A little bit of a bet?
Know, not long after my accident, we did the Marine Corps Marathon together. And he actually pulled my sorry ass through that whole thing. And I felt bad about it because, you know, he could have run it twice in the time it took me to get through it. And I told him, I said, you know, on this one, you're not going to do that. He said, oh, no, I'm leaving you in the dust, pal. So it's we'll have to come up with a weighted score or some sort of grading on a curve, I think.
I love it. Now, what have you learned about yourself through all of this? It's not like a lot of our challenged athletes, you know, they're kids and they're 3, 4, 5 years old. And it's almost their reality has been that way since they were very young. You're an adult. You had your whole life. You'd done so much already. What did you learn about yourself through this process?
I learned that I was trying to live my life as if I was an island, doing it all myself. You know, the symbolism of me being in the Philippines as a one-man band says a lot about who I was. And I had the idea in my head that reaching out and asking for help was a sign of weakness. And I learned by necessity that it's exactly the opposite. And we all derive great power beyond what we can do individually from each other. And understanding that is such an important lesson. And if I had overlooked that lesson in my life, I would have missed something very meaningful and powerful. I'm not saying it was good I lost my arm, but that was the good thing that came out of it. And if I had never learned that lesson versus losing my arm, I'm glad I learned the lesson, put it that way.
So what new stories are you working on besides the fact that you're training 38 hours a day?
Yeah, I'm doing that, and I'm doing a story today. We're editing a piece for the PBS NewsHour on the dolphins that are the seven dolphins, which are at the National Aquarium in Baltimore. That aquarium has made the decision to release them to a sanctuary, and so we're following that process of the dolphins going from a concrete tank to a more natural setting, probably in Florida. And that's been a really interesting story because it gets into all kinds of questions about what's humane for, you know, caging animals for display, and you know, how smart these animals are, how beautiful they are. It's such a thrill to be around them and their trainers. And I'm also doing a film for New Mexico Public Television on the links between music and math. Now, I'm not very musical, and I was very anti-math in school, so this has been a way out of my comfort zone piece. And we spent 4 days with the Santa Fe Symphony Orchestra and a mathematician doing a special presentation talking about rhythms and resonances and frequencies and harmonics and how that all relates to the mathematical and the natural world. And it really sounds like heavy lifting. It is, but it's really an interesting film, I think. So I'll let you know when we have it done. But and for me, you know, going back to what I was saying, you know, this is the history major doing stuff like that. And I think you would agree that when you stop learning and stop moving forward and stop going for that goal physically or career-wise or mentally, when you stop that, you might as well lay down and die. So I think it's important we all keep moving forward, keep learning, and keep doing new things.
One of the things that I talk about all the time is the importance of sport, especially for athletes who've been, you know, who've lost limbs or are in wheelchairs, that sport can be cathartic and really you're accomplishing something, you're feeling good about yourself, you got those endorphins, and it changes you for the better when you're able to get back in the sport. Did you find that after your trauma?
Yeah, it was so essential to me that I get back to, you know, I'm not a competitive triathlete by any stretch. Right. I just do it because it makes me feel good.
Exactly.
I frequently will find myself at loggerheads on a script, a little bit of writer's block. I'll go out and run for 45 minutes and boom, there's the idea. It's
yep.
Just like, I can't tell you how often that has happened to me. And so that's really important. It's not just the physical well-being. It's such a mental high, and it kind of reboots the brain in a way that really feeds the rest of my life, how I relate to my friends and loved ones, how I do my job. It's all part of the big picture. And I remember that one of the first runs I did after I lost my arm, I, you know, of course my balance is all messed up, and I was running over an uneven sidewalk near my house in Washington, and I fell flat on my face. And as I was going down, I went to break the fall with my missing arm. It didn't work so well. So instead of stopping it, I went straight on my face, on my nose, broke my nose. And it was a big setback, and I really had that. That was one of the darkest moments of all, believe it or not, because I thought, oh, God, I'm not going to be able to get back to who I was. And it's not just saying I'm a runner. It's everything. It's all part and parcel in the package. And that idea that I couldn't do something as simple as a run really hit me hard. And so, after I got through with the pity party and got my nose set and everything, I kind of got back into it like everything else I was just telling you about. I figured out, instead of thinking about how much easier it was to run with two arms, I started running with a lot more attention to where I was putting my feet. And you know what? It's okay. It's, you know, now that those balance issues have gone away and I'm back to it. But it was so important to me to get back to that. And when I thought I couldn't, it was really a devastating thing.
When you mentioned the dolphins, it's interesting. You know, the whole Dolphin Tale movie with Winter the Dolphin.
Oh, yeah.
That actually, believe it or not, the guy who runs the Clearwater Aquarium, David Yates, was president of the Ironman.
I didn't know that connection.
Yep. And when Winter was first brought there, his first call was to Challenge Athletes Foundation to find out about who made the prosthetics for our athletes.
Yeah.
And we connected him with the prosthetist who built the tail for Winter.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Really fun stuff. So if people out there would like to participate, challengedathletes.org, we have spots for the sold-out Ironman 70.3 coming up on April 7th in Oceanside, and Miles O'Brien will be racing there. Miles, I want to thank you for taking so much time and chatting. It's great to have you part of the CAF family, and I'm looking forward to you kicking your son's butt on April 7th in Oceanside.
On a curve.
On a curve. We will come up with a system where he should give you at least an hour. You think?
I would think
an hour.
At least.
Yeah. Right. I think we just, you're the dad, right? Don't you come up with the bets? It's an hour. He needs to give you an hour. I love it.
All right.
Perfect. All right, Mr. Miles O'Brien has been our guest again. We are brought to you by Toughman Triathlon. It's toughmantri.com, VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, RunCatalina.com, Catalina Marathon coming up Saturday, March 10th, our Challenged Athletes Foundation, challengedathletes.org. We will be sending out our new series of grants coming up in April to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. We've sent out over 18,000 grants in our first 24 years. We are now in our 25th year. Check out any of our interviews on babbittville.com or on iTunes. And until next time, remember, endurance lives